Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays. You're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like? Because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora. He's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/Count the Dings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Tom, fish, chicken, or beef, you got only one for the rest of your life. You got to send the other two packing. Which is it?
All right, I'm sending chicken and fish. Pack your knives and go. I'm going with beef because I can do beef tartare. I can do beef jerky. I can do Philly cheesesteaks. I can do just like a tenderloin or ribeye. I can do burgers. I can do hamburgers, ground beef, stroganoff. I can do tons of stuff with beef. And you know what? If I do the chicken thing, I feel like I'm just going to eat chicken wings the whole time. So you know what? I'm going with beef.
The answer is fish.
No, no, no. Kevin, no. That's such an LA answer, just for the record.
I'm not giving up Japanese food. I'm just not. I've already given up beef, so that one's the easy. You're correct that it's a harder decision in this sense. The problem with being a pescatarian, and one of the reasons I've come up to the line but have never crossed over it, is there are too many places in the world, there are too many situations, you're road tripping, wherever, where fish just isn't an option, where if you're only protein chicken, you can always find something. Every culinary tradition, you can be in a little village anywhere in the world and poultry is going to be served. Fish is a little harder to get fresh. There's a lot of bad salmon on menus around the world. You're absolutely right. But I can't give up the Japanese. I can never not have sushi ever again. I just can't even fathom the possibility.
I hear that.
This is Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Arnovitz.
And I'm Tom Haberstroh.
Tom, it's a top 10. The chefs are still in Dane County in Madison, Wisconsin. We have another, and I want to talk with you about another team challenge. How do we feel that way? It is becoming more commonplace. I think there's some strengths. I think there's some weaknesses to the strategy, just from a production standpoint. We have some conflict. Tom, you know, for years, you and I have been talking about, hey, it's a little bit, is it Top Friend or is it Top Chef? The budgetary issue in this particular episode introduces some conflict. So I want to hear all about it. I mean, what is your big takeaway? Obviously, other than elimination and winner, what are your kind of broad strokes here?
I wasn't a huge fan of the team challenge here, and this is why. We've had a bunch of team challenges already, and we know that Restaurant Wars is coming up. So I feel like we just did kind of a Restaurant Wars-y episode here. where two teams, you have to do a 5-course meal with these types of these 5 dishes and order them out. And part of the fun of Restaurant Wars is you kind of see this deliberation of like, who's going to take dessert, who's going to take front of house, who's going to be the executive chef. And it almost felt like in this episode, we got like an exhibition Restaurant Wars. And yeah, they're not coming up with a theme of the restaurant, but I feel like just too many team challenges, and beside the point, but it really screws up with the fantasy scoring. And you kind of feel like Manny or Manny was on the bottom team anyway, so it didn't matter. But like Kevon, he had probably the worst dish.
Easily.
He's still there because it was a team challenge, and I get it. We got to spruce up some things and break out into teams at least a couple times a season, but it feels like we're overdoing it. I didn't like that format for this episode.
I think one of the misgivings I have about team challenges is exactly what happened and what you alluded to with Kevon, which is if the worst chef of the day is not going home, there's a structural issue with the program, right? Like that should happen. And it's like, hey, well, good luck that he happened to cook with, you know, he happened to be wearing a purple smock rather than a green one, right? Like that shouldn't happen. I want the best chefs rewarded and I want the worst chefs going home. And so that's my other thing. Now, the other thing I would say is, again, I'm with you. It was Restaurant Wars without the restaurant. It's an individual challenge masquerading as a team challenge.
Yes. Baseball.
Now, the only qualification there, and I want to talk about it later when we get to the elimination, is the budgetary element. They were restricted to $1,000 for basically almost 50 diners. So we're talking about they had to do this high-end meal for basically $20 and change a person. And that did introduce a team element in terms of cooperation, and it required some selflessness. Hey, take my ingredients, even though I'm going to get nicked. And I do want to talk about that because I thought that was very interesting. It added a lot to the show. It was, to me, the great salvaging of the team challenge. Do we want to start with Quickfire first? I thought that was also, I liked this Quickfire. Because I'm a farmer's market. I'm one of these Los Angeles farmer's market people, and I just love watching a Sunday morning where you got the producers out, and this one is a particularly good farmer's market. I did think, what did you think of, let me ask you a question though. What do you think of shopping for the ingredients before you hear about the Quickfire Challenge? Would you not have preferred for them to get a sense of their sauce and then go buy the ingredient?
I liked the whole blind shopping of that. I did think that it was a challenge in of itself. Sometimes with quick fires, I want to see just them cook a really nice dish, and I don't want them have to, you know, cook the dish with a blindfolded with their arm behind their back and wearing a spacesuit.
Right.
Like, I'm okay with doing a blind shop and then doing the Chef Gully lesson and his history lesson. It didn't seem too limiting. Like, I do think that some of the chefs were a little disappointed. Like, oh, I wish I could have done a shakshuka, like a true shakshuka or whatever it was. But it didn't seem totally antithetical with the two things. Like, they didn't seem like a huge disagreement. So I was excited about the blind shop. And the sauces were, I think, what's the word I'm looking for? They weren't so narrow that you couldn't kind of interpret it or use it in a certain way.
Right.
Like a mustard sauce, a Creole sauce, a mushroom sauce. It wasn't very narrow. And I felt like if you did do a shop, you could basically get 90% of the way of what you were thinking. So I didn't hate it. I actually enjoyed the quickfire better than I liked the elimination challenge.
Yeah, my chance is we ended up with like a lot of salads.
Yeah.
Because you're at a farmer's market.
Well, you're the farmer's market guy. You should have a...
No. I love salad. But it essentially was, hey, it ended up being somewhat of a salad challenge. You know, I mean, Manny ended up with a piece of trout from a local producer, which was cool. Mm-hmm. Michelle, inexplicably, the one person who probably should have done a salad because of her sauce, did a frittata. And that was Michelle, really one of her only errors of the season with the raisin sauce. But the chef, Carson Gully thing was very cool. So... you remember the still photograph of him with all those pies? So he was famous for the fudge bottom pie. This is a dessert that is it's an icebox pie, very famous to Wisconsin, like graham cracker, but like crust, but on top of the graham cracker is this layer of fudge. And what's even cooler about Carson Gully is that the University of Wisconsin in Madison's online library website You can go on there and see every page in the cookbook. So I got to look at all the sauce recipes, and I went through his entire recipe book. I think I'm going to make some Chef Carson Gully food this year because the library system of Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin, does a wonderful job of getting his entire body of work. You can just like search the text of his cookbook by item. So that was very cool.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was a very cool thing. And like, yay, university library online systems for geeks like us.
You know, you say this as I'm writing like a big story about the NBA and needing to go to the Sports Illustrated vault. The SI vault used to be amazing.
Yes. It
had every single Sports Illustrated, every page with the advertisements in them from the 70s, 80s, 90s and beyond. And now I'm having to go back and research something in like 1988 and it's gone. I can't flip through the Sports Illustrated anymore because of the whole terrible thing that happened above Sports Illustrated. And it just seems like those digitized libraries, we should have some sort of like Library of Congress, make sure that everything that was digitized maintains digitized.
I think SI's entire history belongs in the Library of Congress, and I think we should start making that happen. The two of us, we could start a further commitment. Yeah, it's outrageous. I mean, those, if you're telling me you cannot find old Gary Smith or features or whatever, like I want a solution to there. But you got 10 chefs, a lot of salad, a lot of eggs. Because it is a farmer's market. Mm. And it was one of these cases, Tom, where the winning quickfire chef, Charlie, ended up was the eliminated chef later in the episode. He kind of won with the Creole sauce, which was perfect. It is very much, he was very excited to get Creole. Tom, explain this one to me. Like, they sort of picked the sauce they wanted, but they kind of didn't. It didn't, like, they were told it didn't matter, as if it doesn't matter which sauce you get. Like, I was very confused by the distribution and assignment work of which sauce belonged to each chef. And like, what was your read there?
It was odd because you saw Dan, you know, get his feathers ruffled a little bit because of Laura, where Laura was like, I'm going to kind of look through a couple of these and see what I want. And then like leave, discard the rest. And Dan was like, that's bullshit. Like, come on. You know, but like, I also understand that Laura like was trying to strategize and was like, yeah, I'm not doing that. So I'm going to go with this and get the herb sauce. And I understand both sides of that because it wasn't very clear. It wasn't like a draw knife situation, draw cards. You kind of walked up and you picked one, but like, if you didn't like it, maybe you could throw it back. And maybe someone's trash is someone else's treasure. So I get it from Laura's perspective. And I don't begrudge Dan being frustrated. I think it was unclear what the prompt was. And just like you said, I like the strategizing of it. Like, of course you're going to read like, oh, is it a Creole sauce or an egg sauce or an herb sauce? Of course you're going to do that.
So there were three finishers at the top, seemed to have three very good dishes. I like when there were 10 chefs because, Tom, I can say like there were three on the top, there were three on the bottom, and there were four in the middle.
Yes.
It's a very symmetrical kind of standings. Charlie won with his fingerling potato and a honey tomato chevre, which is a lovely little sweet balanced touch to, you know, what must have been a very spicy sauce. He had a little florets of broccolini, it looked like there. Laura, you know, continued to do good work. You know, she's done well at the top of the show. She did her herb sauce. She did a fattoush salad, which works very well. And then Manny got a Figaro sauce, which I've never heard of. It turns out it is a Carson Gully advent. In fact, I went online and I could not find one mention of Figaro sauce that didn't belong to Carson Gully. It's kind of basically a Pomodoro. So he did a rainbow trout. And I think it was probably good for Manny. I think by the one guy who basically got an animal protein ended up kind of on the top. No surprise there. Because the rest of the field, you know, it was like, hey, Savannah's doing a poached egg over a stone fruit salad, which looked really nice, but it's a poached egg over a stone fruit salad with mustard sauce, right? Rafika did her Spanish sauce. She did a tomato-based Moroccan stew with topped with jalapeno popcorn, one of those kind of prepared items you get at the farmer's market. It's kind of goofy that you can use, so good for her for there.
I got a little nervous when she put that on there, I got to admit. Not because it was too spicy, but because it was a store-bought like jalapeno popcorn. But it's from the farmer's market, so feels like it's probably an organic or homemade. We're not talking some you know, mass produced popcorn here. Although I will say, Manny, when the fish came out, the rainbow trout came out, I was like, ooh, that's going to win just by virtue of having a protein on the plate. So kudos to him. Like you said, good shop for him, getting the rainbow trout on there. And, you're right. You had the Danny with the cucumbers, the pickled cucumbers with the cold horseradish cream, which I'm going to go look up that recipe because I love a good horseradish. And there was a lot of, you know, salads here.
A lot of salads.
It's tough. Like, it's a farmer's market challenge, you know?
Oh, wait, did I make a mistake? Wait, Kevin had schnitzel, so he had another animal protein.
Yeah, but okay, he wanted to do a shakshuka, but then he did a mushroom sauce with the schnitzel. It was a ham schnitzel, I believe.
So that's the second protein. I was wrong on the only of the trout.
But, like, when you're at a farmer's market, I think the fish goes better with the light spring vegetables and natural just ingredients. I do feel like it was a smart move to go with the rainbow trout. Now, Kevin, I noted that Laura did not do herself favors with Dan. I didn't know if they played that up a little much. And I kind of felt like she, by virtue of they had a little story with her to open the episode, that maybe, you know, this would signal that Laura went home. And then in the next episode, I mean, next challenge, we kind of got the whole, usually the Whole Foods or the shop is really boring. And I think that's like, kind of like if you're gonna fast forward through any of these episodes, that probably is generally where you're gonna be like, you know what? I want to see them cook. But this one packed a lot of drama.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of surprising because initially when they said, ooh, $1,000, I think they all had this like, ooh, this will be easy. No split, like no problem. I'm gonna be able to do this. And then once it started adding up, you could feel the tense. Because it becomes a turf war at that point, doesn't it, Kevin?
Yeah, well, and also like $1,000 for, it was 40 diners plus the judges table.
Yeah.
So, and that was what, there were 8 people. So you're basically talking about $20 a person. Like, I can't make dinner for six for $120. I mean, that is not a lot of food. I'm very conflicted about the budget thing. On one hand, I love it for the reason you just mentioned, right? It created conflict right there. They had to, you know, you had Danny going back. Basically, he had this relish platter. He had to basically go, hey, I've got enough. What, I mean, he cursed. It was like, I only have enough food for 12 people. We're cooking for like 40 or 50. You had everybody kind of side-eyeing Laura. Like, Laura's one of those competitors. Like, there are two kinds of, like, I wouldn't say villains, but, you know, there are two archetypes of, well, villainous behavior on Top Chef. There is the aggressive, and then there's the kind of the unwittingly selfish. She is in the unwittingly selfish. Like, oh, I'm just going to rifle through these sauces and to hell with everybody else. But I'm going to have a smile on my face about it. I'm not going to raise my voice. Like, oh, I'm going to get a massive Costco-sized thing of rum or cognac, whatever the hell that was. Like,
yeah.
And even though I'm doing dessert, I'm going to spend like $400 of the $1,000 because I have to do two desserts. Never mind that the poor schmuck who's got a pickle, you know, basically put a bunch of pickles on a plate, basically gets like 11 cents. You know, like she's kind of that. But the one problem, I do want to get into one thing, though, about the budget. And it's a larger issue that we're already seeing with this season. This is a great season of Top Chef, Tom, for all the reasons you've talked about with Kristen. And it seems like there's a lot of parody. And we've seen some great, like, I love Rasika as a character and as a chef. But the food isn't very good. Week in and week out, you look at the elimination challenge where there are almost a dozen chefs still in the competition and maybe one great plate, maybe two, maybe. And the problem with the budget is that it's cool to create conflict, and I'm really positive about that. But what you're not doing is allowing chefs to create great food. Because, I mean, Tom, I ask you this. Is there any doubt that Michelle wouldn't have had a more successful dessert if she had more resources and enough pineapple? Is there no question that Danny, who I think is one of the most skilled chefs in the competition, wouldn't have had a better kind of starter relish / mezze platter had he had real budget? Is it no question that Rasika, who has this kind of weird sauce that nobody liked, but she wanted to do a green chutney, but didn't have the ingredients because nobody could afford it. Like, the budget also, it makes for a more interesting competition, but it also, they're not producing great food this season. And this is a reason, this week, was the reason why.
I totally agree with you. I would also say, even with the limited ingredients or the shop, the constraints of the shop, I was so disappointed with Kevin and Manny's steak. How do you screw that up? How do you screw up a tenderloin or a New York strip when they were like, oh, I'm going to do a New York strip with a little side of with jus? I was like, this seems like a very simple dish. The margin for error is quite large. Like, it just seems like a nothing dish. And he blew it. And then the same thing with Manny, where he was like, I'm going to do a New York strip steak because it's a Monterey thing and it's kind of our lobster of the New England. And I'm sitting there being like, I could do a strip steak. That's not a hard cook. And then he blew it again. And so even what you're saying, like I'm
that's fair.
I hear what you're saying, but also they screwed it up anyway. And it would just seemed like, Kevin, I don't want to kvetch.
No, you got a good point. That had nothing to do with budget. In fact, those guys got their protein and they just screwed it up, irrespective of how much it costs. That's a good point. Point taken.
I'm agreeing with you, but also I'm pointing out that like they just blew it. They screwed up their dishes and it seemed like a pretty easy execution, right, Kevin? Like I'm not in the kitchen as much as you are, but when you're telling me like a beef tenderloin with a jus sauce that, as they said, was mooing on the plate, and that the one of the reviewers was basically like, yeah, this is it still has a name here. You know what it is? Are we just watching a season after Buddha and a World All-Stars that we just feel like the level of competition just went from like the NBA finals to like Detroit versus Charlotte? Like, is there a little bit of that where it's such a whiplash from last season to this season?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tough for them, right? Because they're following a season where Begonia is going home in the middle, right? I mean, she probably wiped the floor this season. I mean, there was so much depth. I mean, it was World All-Stars. It was people who've won their entire seasons and they're part of the world. It was a particularly good season. And even the prior season, like I think they've been on a hot streak. You know, you think about the number of times in the last few years where Tom or Padma said, hey, this might be the best season of Top Chef ever. I don't think that's going to happen this season. And I don't say that to kind of denigrate this particular field of chefs. I'm just noting that week in and week out, we're not seeing great food. And we're seeing a great show. And I love watching Kristen grow into the job. And I think some of the challenges have been very creative. And actually, I praise the show for introducing a little more conflict. And you could argue maybe the conflict is introducing less good food. And maybe the fact that, they kind of cut conflict out of the show and all of a sudden we started seeing maybe there's an argument to be made that actually conflict is inversely proportional to the level of cooking.
That's good.
And maybe that's it.
You can't have one without the other.
Right.
If you want conflict, you're gonna have to let the constraints sing a little bit. The conflict comes from the constraints. So maybe you're right. I think that's probably most of this is that the constraints are limiting them to a point where they're just not able to shine. And we can't have one without the other.
Hello, listener. Guess who's back? It's me, Anthony Mays, your favorite butcher turned podcast producer, and I'm here to talk to you about ButcherBox. ButcherBox is the most convenient way to get high quality meat and seafood that you can trust delivered straight to your doorstep, free shipping, vacuum sealed packaging. It's ready to go right then. It's ready to pop in the freezer. You get exclusive member deals and a variety of high quality cuts at an amazing value. Going to the grocery store can be a huge pain. You're usually in a rush at an inconvenient time. You're waiting in line at the meat counter. You're taking a number. Maybe this place doesn't have a number. You're jostling with fellow customers. You're trying to get that ribeye that you want or that nice piece of salmon. Maybe the butcher that you're dealing with has a bad attitude or something. I don't know. That was never me, I promise. But maybe it happens. ButcherBox takes all of that out of the picture. You are always prepared with meat and seafood in the freezer, and you're not going to find quality for this price anywhere else other than ButcherBox. So sign up at butcherbox.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S, and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order.
want to do? Do you want to go through the green team and the purple team, or you want to go a little head-to-head action?
Well, let's talk about first the supper club. What are your thoughts on the idea of supper club and the elimination challenge of... I have not participated in a supper club. It seemed fun. I think the Harvey House and the hosts, it seemed like a cool atmosphere, and it gave me like the crooning, you know, 1920s atmosphere. That ambiance and that theme was fun to me.
Yeah.
The relish tray, fish dish, chicken dish, beef dish, dessert. I'm surprised that the round that had the best food seemed to be the relish dish. I was surprised by that. I thought it was going to be a throwaway, just like a crudité. Let's just get it over with, kind of palate cleanser. And it actually was the star of the episode, was Dan and Danny's. But yeah, let's go with the winning team. Let's go with the purple team, where I thought Dan did an excellent job with his chicken liver mousse. There was good story there because of his childhood and how that was, you know, as a Wisconsinite, that was a staple in his household. With the steak tartare and the crudité, I was all about that dish.
It's a great, in some ways it was the successful version of Kevin's botched olive canapé back in the early stage, right? Like let's put a couple of different appetizers on a plate. It was essentially a sampler platter, right? In classic supper club tradition, like these old school items, right? Like chicken liver, steak tartare, you know, the crudité is about as sort of old school as it gets. One thing I didn't get was, I want to know what his soil was that Gail loved so much. I know that it was crudité in soil. Was the soil like... Was it grain? What was that soil?
Yeah.
We'll have to ask Dan if we have him on. I'd love to know that.
Yeah, what was that? That's a good question. Yeah, when Dan comes on, let's ask him about what the grain was or the soil was, because it wasn't a couscous. It wasn't...
It looked grainy, but I don't know what it was.
Yeah.
Quinoa, maybe, possibly. By the way, it looked like I really loved what Danny did, given he clearly got one of the short ends of the stick in terms of resources. He did basically a mezza platter, which is a wonderful way to kind of do relish, right? So he had the black tahini, black garlic dip. He had the Lebanese za'atar. He had pickles. And then kind of did a little Wisconsin play by doing kind of the smoked whitefish, right? So he got like, but I thought he did a very clever job. And apparently, though he was unhappy, it seemed like the judges were generally pleased with his tray. And I like the mezza platter as a take on the relish platter.
Okay, what did you think about him falling on his sword before he got the judge's review? Because I thought that was an interesting strategy.
I think he was just honest. Like, I get the sense with Danny, like, he's a guy who's hard on himself and holds himself to a high standard. And just, I think, between kind of not having the resources he probably wanted and then feeling like he didn't do the best with what he did, I don't think it was a deflection. I think he legitimately was sort of like, you know, when we're all sitting around in the supper club last night, conceiving of what we could do with our, and he was so excited. And then what he turned out was less than what he wanted. I mean, I thought it was a very honest, unvarnished revelation from a chef who's just really hard on himself.
Yeah, it's like a guy who in the 3-point shooting contest, like, doesn't do a great job, but it's not that you have to do a great job. It's just relative to everybody else. And so when he's the first one up there and they're like, hey, how did you feel about your cook? And he's like, not up to my standard, you know, honestly, a little too salty. I get it. Compared to everybody else, Danny did a great job in this episode, and we'll get to the scoring later. I want to talk to you about how we should score this one, but I thought he had an upper half dish and potentially a top three dish in the conversation for the top three dish.
Yeah.
And if he was like the last person to talk on his dish, probably he wouldn't have been as hard on himself, because once he saw everybody else's review, he would have been like, yeah, My thing was damn good.
By the way, this is the second time in a row he's kind of sacrificed, right? He did the more muted version of remember the very with Rosica last week, where she did this sort of the Dal Canal, and he did a more mild scallop mousse with the green chartreuse, right? The very mild little egg cream. He's, by the way, he's still a co-favorite for me in this competition. I mean, that's the thing with Danny, and I think he is a guy who's going to benefit from going back to an individual format, at least for a week before Restaurant Wars. Actually, it'll be a couple of weeks because the Last Chance Kitchen people are coming back soon. But I think he's a guy who is feeling a little constrained, who's not able to be as creative as he would like to be in a less limited, less team-oriented challenge. And he's a little crabby right now, and I understand it, because he is as skilled as any chef on that show, and he's not getting a full opportunity to show off right now.
We heard it from Buddha in our premium episode interview with Buddha. If you haven't checked it out, go do that now because he surprised me. He said, actually, I thought that Danny's version of that dish last week was better than Rossica's. That was his favorite dish. And so I think Danny still, like you, I feel like he's the co-favorite here going forward. I actually thought it was endearing, or I really actually liked him more after he said, you know what, it wasn't my favorite dish. I could have done better. And Tom Colicchio, of all people, was just like, you did a pretty good job. That was actually a pretty good dish. And that's got to feel good if you're Danny. It's like, ooh, I'm harder on myself than Tom is.
I think it speaks well for him. Like, he is not satisfied right now with being upper middle. He wants to win every competition.
Can we talk about Rosca?
Yeah, let's do the fish.
I want to do something before that about Rosca.
All right.
When she and Michelle are talking about the dessert versus the fish, what did you think about that? Because I felt really bad for Michelle in that moment where Michelle doesn't have immunity. She staked her claim. She planted her flag and said, I want to do a fish dish. And then here comes Rosica, who's like, I don't want to do dessert because I've already done dessert and I have a really good idea for a fish dish. So if you don't mind, I would like to do a fish dish. And Michelle goes, hey, I'm a twin. I'm a team player. Sure, Rosica. And Rosica goes, yeah, I know I have immunity. I just really don't want to do a dessert again. I felt for Michelle there.
I felt for Michelle too. And I feel like social protocol on the show would dictate that if you have elimination and if you have immunity in that situation, that you defer to the others, mm-hmm. you take whatever's left. That would be my instinct. Now you could argue that, hey, Rosca's also, as your standings, as of last week noted, is on just an absolute tear. And if she feels like, hey, the best way for me to help this team and ensure that nobody goes home here is for me to do my, I mean, she has been, you could argue, the most creative, the most generative chef in the competition, I think by far. I mean, like, I don't think it's close. And so that would be the argument is, hey, I know it seems like I'm making a selfish play here. I know you don't want to do dessert. Let me do fish, and it is going to be part of a winning coalition of dishes that is going to mean that nobody here goes home. And that would be the only argument. But I'm with you. I felt bad for Michelle. I think at the end of the day, as much as I can make the argument for Rosica, I think you just, as the immunity chef, you just got to defer to the others. Take whatever's left. Be classy. And you know what? You're a great chef. I had no doubt that Rosica could have nailed any of those five categories.
Yeah, it just rubbed me the wrong way. Like, I was like, ooh, Rosca, Mina Kimes said that she already has a parasocial relationship with Rosica after watching these episodes. And I was like, yeah, Rosca's awesome. And I love watching her so far. That was the only time that I've been like, I don't know. That was kind of a, not a bully move, but a selfish one. And one that I felt like Michelle has earned her stripes a little bit, yes. That she's won an elimination challenge. She deserves a little bit more benefit of the doubt there, when maybe it's an edit thing. Maybe the edit portrayed it a little bit spicier than it was. But it seemed like Michelle really took one in the chin there. And I felt like that was, it's one of the reasons why I admire her so much is, I thought that she got a raw deal in that exchange where she ended up having to do the dessert, and she really did a great job with her dessert. And Rosica, not that she's going home after her dish, but she didn't nail her dish in a way that, right. Like, if you do kick someone out of that entree, you got to make sure you nail it.
You're absolutely right. It was her weakest dish of the competition. She did a semolina fried snapper, a peanut jaggery, kind of a sweet peanut. Peanut jaggery sauce dip is almost like that good stuff that you get with satay, that good, yummy, peanutty kind of sesame sauce. And then a smoked sturgeon herb sauce, which should have been her green chutney that I know she would have nailed. I mean, I will argue that nobody, the very few, of all the chefs that got hurt by the budgetary constraints, outside of Danny, Rosica, by basically giving up her green chutney and doing an herb sauce that didn't work, that was far too salty. But her fish dish was better than Charlie's. Charlie ultimately went home for his Epis rubbed fried trout that he just cooked way too far in advance. Let sit. Fish will cook. Even after it's out of the pan, fish will cook. Apparently had it in the oven too. His pickles, ironically, were not spicy enough, and that got him another nick. And in fact, had he nailed that, I wonder if Manny takes the fall.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I just had a thought, Kevin. Haven't we had like a team head to head where it's you're in teams, but you have to win your head to head matchup,
right.
And the loser goes to the bottom. We could have done that on this episode, right?
I think that would have been the preferred structure, is basically have them pick knives or fine, have the teams go where like that thing, like, hey, you're going up first, you're up second, you're up third, or you do this. You go head to head. And then the five people standing in front of the judges' tables for the win are the five winners of the head to heads, right? Mm-hmm. And then the five, I totally agree with you. You can still do it as a team competition. But there's no reason, like Kevin should be going home. He had the weakest dish. There are 10 people cooking 10 individual dishes. I know they're part of a team, but you're absolutely right, Tom. Why not do it that way where you do your batting order, it's head to head. We won 3-2, we're the winning team. But the losers are, and if you wanna say, hey, if you're on the winning team, you don't go home, then fine, it's the, you know, maybe it's the two losers. I don't know, but I agree with you there. That's probably a better way to do it.
The downside to that is Danny gets punished for going up against Dan's dish.
But he ain't going home.
But then of the five, you're gonna pick three out of the five that are in the bottom. So Danny is in the middle. And also, Danny is still in the losing team right now, right? So like, yeah, it's not an ideal situation, but the status quo isn't ideal either because he's in the bottom anyway. So I think we should have had something like that. And Charlie, by the way, it feels like we're nitpicking a lot on the structure of the show right now, or the games of the show, the game design. I thought it would have been interesting, even though the research shows that picking your teams actually might be worse for you, that the team where you win the first pick and you get to decide your team first actually is a disadvantage empirically. I thought it would have been cool if, as the quickfire winner, I get it, he got $7,500 or he got a some sort of cash prize, $7,500 from Wells Fargo. Thank you, Wells Fargo. But it would have been cool if there was almost like another incentive or another advantage or another benefit for Charlie in this team challenge, whether it's he picks his team or he gets first pick. That would have been cool to kind of tie these two things together, because what we did have in this episode, I think, someone correct me in the audience, comment if I get this wrong, did we just have our first quickfire challenge winner get eliminated in the second one, or is it just we sometimes they don't get a quickfire immunity? And yes, we've had quickfire winners get sent home later, but it did feel like this is a very rare instance that we had a quickfire winner go home later in the episode.
Yeah, I mean, there've only been a couple of quickfires. Laura won the second quickfire. Rossica won in the third episode. And then last week there was no quickfire. So this is only the third quickfire.
I'm saying historically, like in past seasons, quickfires usually give you immunity, but sometimes they don't. And sometimes quickfire winners go home, but it's very rare that we have this situation with Charlie. And I'm wondering, you know, he's obviously very happy to get the cash, but did you feel like it was fine that there was no like benefit tie-in to the elimination challenge for the winner of the quickfire?
We talked about it last week. I don't love this sort of immunity every week thing, especially when it creates situations like last week where a person, Charlie, ironically had immunity just by virtue of being paired with Michelle.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I don't mind. I think one of the things I love about Top Chef is even when Quickfire doesn't carry with it immunity, it's always important. Like, I think winning and losing and finishing on the top and bottom of Quickfire has a psychic benefit and a psychic toll on the competitors, and you see it. Mm. Like, people are it gives you something even better than sometimes cash, which is confidence in the next thing. Although I would argue cash is pretty cool. And Charlie, yeah, not a bad week, right? Like, if you're gonna get sent home, better do it with a $7,500 check in your pocket. For the chicken dish, Tom, we had two katsus going head to head.
Yeah.
We had Amanda's katsu and Savannah's katsu. And somebody in the audience also checked me on this. Savannah referred to hers as tonkatsu. I think ton means pork in Japanese. So it wasn't exactly tonkatsu. I think it was just katsu. But we had two katsus going head to head, which I thought was very interesting. And also, I want to kind of reinstate my appreciation for Amanda. I know she's had a bumpy ride. I know she hasn't finished it toward the top very often. I still think conceptually she's coming up with good plates. And in this case, she had the strongest dish on the green team. And I kind of applauded. She did a hot chicken katsu with a Szechuan spice and apple miso mustard sauce. Tom, mm-hmm. I want to work on that apple. I'm going to go into the lab and in the kitchen and try some apple miso mustard sauce. That is a sauce I would love to serve with chicken. And then it kind of did a very well seasoned red cabbage and sauerkraut. Could have been a throwaway. It wasn't a throwaway. She aced it only before getting sick later and not being able to enjoy the praise of the judges' table for her dish.
Oh, poor thing. That would have been so cool to be able to hear the judges, you know, give her praise on her dish because she earned it. She, like you said, she's been a really strong competitor. And I thought that Savannah really held her own here too. And they were a little confused on the caviar aspect, but I hope that she had told her story to the judges about the caviar and how that's something, a tradition that they have in her kitchen, right, back at her restaurant. And that I think would have landed better. And they always like to imbue that story into the dish too. So I think, you know, the caviar would have made sense if Savannah was able to explain it a little bit more. But she did a great job with her dish as well. Both of those, the way they looked very similar, but they also looked delicious. And I thought this, compared to the following, the steak, the beef entree, I thought Amanda and Savannah did an excellent job here.
Yeah, I think with Savannah, it's one of those, I think one of the cardinal rules of Top Chef, particularly Colicchio, and Gail often mentions it as well, is take one thing off before leaving the house on a dish, right? And I think the caviar was the thing that you just, like, was a hat on a hat. And just a little big. But I'm with you. Had you only said, hey, look, when we do, you know, when we do kind of the late night menu, it's something we have our caviar and we will, you know, I think that would have been a great story. And I think probably could have gotten her away with it.
Our own little supper club. Yeah. Yes. When we do our own little supper club, this is how we do it. So, it, you know, there's no momentum in basketball. There's no momentum, you know, going from the regular season to the postseason. There is no momentum when it comes to the chicken dish to the beef dish, Kevin, is there?
No, God. And as you said, I mean, we kind of talked about it. I mean, it's, you know, as much as I'm saying, hey, the budget limitations might have lessened the food. No, this was not, that was not the issue. Both guys just bricked their meat, you know, and, you know, Manny tried to rescue a little sous vide. That's a very a good idea. I imagine, though I'm not a cilantro guy, nor are you, his cilantro. Epazote Marcona almond salsa verde looked like a very nice accompaniment. He had the horseradish pomme puree, though as Kristen said, hey, having a chewy steak with pomme puree can kind of be soft on soft. It eats the same way. I mean, the funny thing about Kevin's beef was it was so bad they were almost speechless. It was the go to commercial break. It was so bad. Let's hang on just its sheer suckitude as we go to commercial, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, again, I can't emphasize this enough. I think, you know, Charlie, they did say, one of the judges said it was sort of inedible. It was overcooked. It didn't have the spice. But when you're talking about Kevin's dish, I don't know. He got saved. He got rescued. And he's got to parlay this somehow in the next episode because he got new life here. He got a free life on this one.
Hey, Tom, and I got to tell you, we need to talk about Kevin because three of his five elimination dishes have been absolute disasters. You're talking about the three canapes.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about the ham and brie croquette.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he has three out of five. Really bad. You know, he did okay with the squid ink raviolo in that first thing. You remember Michelle did the lovely ricotta and lobster stuffed pasta. He finished kind of in the middle of that pasta division. The squid ink, the raviolo were a little thick, but they liked the fennel puree with the lobster and shrimp. And he obviously, according to Buddha, he had the best dish in last week's elimination with the little triangular chocolate praline dessert. But this guy has a 60% just disaster rate.
Clunk rate,
Tom.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you start thinking about, you know, when you get to this point in the middle of the season, it starts to whittle down. Like, who are you worried about? Who are you worried about? If you had to take a morning line bet on who is the next chef to be eliminated, I got to tell you, he seems so affable. What a great guy he seems like. Not just because he has a great name with an accent and goo on top of it to boot. But
no question.
I just feel like I'd probably walk up to the counter and take that ticket. My money is on Kevin to be eliminated. He is just not performing in elimination situations.
And given where he went in the draft, and because he was Top Chef finalist in Top Chef France, and given that Manny was the number one pick because he won the first elimination challenge, how soon has it flipped on its head where Kevin and Manny are at the bottom of this episode? Charlie gets sent home. I have some thoughts about Laura here in the dessert, Of course, heading up against Michelle. We talked about Michelle, you know, going basically, she calls dibs on the fish and then ends up with the dessert. And maybe I'm misreading this, but I feel like she's done this a lot this season where she kind of just creates a masterpiece out of thin air. And yeah, there wasn't enough pineapple on Tom's plate, but someone else had too much pineapple. So it was like, you know what? It was just a little uneven. she could have done a little bit better, but man, that sounds good. Like the bread pudding with a roasted pineapple sauce on top, the cream sauce.
Oh yeah.
Ugh. I'm salivating. I'm drooling a little bit as I'm talking about it. I love pineapple. Is like a top three fruit in my opinion, maybe even top one.
Tom, let's talk about pineapple upside down cake. One of the great sort of middle brow advents in the dessert category. Can we just talk about pineapple upside down cake? Goodness gracious.
I mean, it's so good.
Oh, so good.
I love a pineapple upside down cake.
So good.
Allison kind of chops up a pineapple and then she throws all the chunks in a Tupperware. And there's like two tall Tupperwares of pineapple in the fridge this afternoon. I pounded one of those after lunch. Just couldn't stop eating pineapple. And it's so good. Fresh pineapple. Few things are better. And you know what? One thing that is better is a bread pudding with roasted pineapple cream sauce. So Michelle... just once again, delivers in a really strong dish. She goes in the top three for me, like in this dish. Laura, it doesn't really make much sense. The brandy, the cocktail, the cuatro leches, it sounded good in theory. It cost way too much money. It hurt her team, created more drama than necessary. It didn't land. She got run over by her team as hard as you can do. I mean, Danny was kind of nudging the judges, just like, yeah, it was tough when I had half of the ingredients I was cooking with. And yeah, Manny, thanks, pal, for helping me out and lending me your veggies because of Laura over here. I thought she was going to be sent home. Honestly, I thought given the shopping plus her dish, I kind of felt that it was going to come down to either her or Charlie on this one, or Manny, I guess. But I was kind of thinking the way that they were telling her story with the way she was raised and her three siblings and the competitive side. There was a part of me that was like, wait a minute, I think Laura might be going home here.
You know, I think it was good enough. I mean, it had that quality, and even the judges grudgingly said, like, I'll eat it, you know, because it's good. I mean, dessert is dessert, and she is a gifted pastry chef. It's very clear, but she's done dessert very well in this competition. But I think in terms of motif, the little after the aperitif with the dessert.
Yeah.
I think the other thing about it is I think it's particularly aggravating because dessert can be done very well, very affordably. Like if you think about the essential elements in dessert, right? Cream, eggs, flour. This is stuff you can go to Whole Foods and you can do dessert on a dime. And in a constrained thing like this, you would like to believe the dessert people were, you know, could they're the one that is the one category. Look, good meat is expensive. Good fish is really expensive, right? The accompaniments on any entree is going to, you're going to need stuff. And I think that's kind of what hurts is that she brings out that massive, I mean, how much of that bottle of brandy or whatever that is, either brandy or rum. I mean, that had to be like you're at Whole Foods, which everything's a ripoff, right? So like
that one bottle,
the 365 stuff is not ripoff. Actually, I've always been pleasantly surprised by the 365 brand, not a ripoff, but name brand stuff, really a ripoff.
That one bottle probably costs Michelle's entire budget.
Yes.
Bread pudding with pineapple and a cream sauce. And she goes head to head with against Laura's dish and then kicks her ass in that matchup. Michelle, very, very proud of her as a member of Team Tom. Kevin, Charlie goes home. I don't think you're too surprised by that. However, I don't feel good about the scoring system here.
Yeah, I don't know what to do.
I don't feel good about it. The team setup does not work for me. It grinds my gears, Kevin. Grinds my gears that it in a traditional scoring format, Kevin would get points.
No.
And Rossica, bless her soul, bless her heart. I don't think she deserved a ton of points on this one by being virtue on the winning team.
No.
So Kevin, I'm gonna read off my top three, bottom three, and middle, and you tell me what you think. Okay.
We'll see if we have the same top three.
Top three. Dan gets the plus 10. Obviously he wins. Mm-hmm. No arguments there. I have Amanda and Michelle.
That's who I have.
I have Amanda and Michelle. Amanda did a great cook on that one. And it's a shame she didn't get to hear it at the judges table. And I hope she's okay. Michelle, she's on there. I think the one that gave me a little bit of question is Savannah and Danny. They were in the running, but I think they're honorable mention for the top three.
Yeah, but I think we agree that Savannah had a little ding that Amanda didn't. Like, I think they enjoyed Amanda's dish a little more, is my interpretation. I have the exact same three you did. I'm so excited because and I, even though it would benefit my team to not have to have Kevin take points instead of give up points, I'm totally with you. And I think we, you know, with the Charlie, Manny, Kevin on the bottom.
Yes.
Is that who you have?
That's who I have. I have Charlie, Kevin, Manny on the bottom. Rossica, Savannah, Laura, and Danny are in the middle. So they each get plus two. I could quibble with Laura getting a plus two here. I'm fine. I'm fine with that. So if I could give a fourth in the bottom three, I would put Laura down there. But like the cook wasn't bad.
No. I don't think there was collective irritation at Laura because of her conduct in terms of the budgeting. But I don't think the dish was an absolute failure. I think it was sort of like one of those classic Tom, hey, don't do duck two ways. Hey, Justin Sutherland, don't do yellowtail two ways. Don't do dessert two ways. Just do one thing. Great. Like, I think my interpretation of her getting kind of, you know, I love, by the way, Tom, just the curmudgeon tour continues. I love it. 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 But my interpretation was he was sort of, I think he got the vibe from the chefs and sort of it took the prerogative to basically, yeah, kind of put her in her place a little bit for her conduct. But I don't think, again, every person, I saw everybody eating that dessert. Like, even bad tres, I mean, because let's be honest, Tom, even bad tres leches is good. just by virtue of the ingredients of a tres leche cake, you're going to, like, the worst tres leche cake is better than most things in life. So I don't think it was like, oh, she just bombed the dessert technically. I think it was just like, hey, given the agita that all of your teammates had over your just ball hogging the budget, you should have done a little better. It should have been the like greatest freaking dessert ever. I think that was sort of the thing. So I'm with you. I think we're on the same page, and I will co-sign your application or your protest or your proposal to the commissioner's office, even though it will cost me points. I'm with you. I think it should be top three, bottom three. I think for the sake of our scoring system and our fantasy system, we hereby are overruling the team structure for episode five and going with your top three and your bottom three, which I co-sign.
And so it has been decreed. All right, good. All right, so we've got that. All right, so what it looks like on the standings here, and I'm including the, which we'll get to, the Last Chance Kitchen results here. 12 points for Team Kevin this week. You were coming out with a bang. 27 points in the first week, 13 in the second, 14 in the fourth episode, 12 points in this most recent episode 5. I came in, I finally beat you here. I had 19 points this week with Danny and Michelle coming out on top here. Sorry, Danny actually only got 2 points. I mistyped it, but yeah, I still win this week, 16-12. Overall, the points, Team Kevin, 66, Team Tom, 53. Let's talk Last Chance Kitchen, Kevin. And then we'll get final thoughts here. So Tom gives a landscape theme because the architecture and Frank Lloyd Wright says, hey, here's 12 dishes or whatever it is. Go choose whichever one you want. They don't run over to the thing and you know, fight over whichever dish. They kind of saunter over and they look at it and they're pondering. And Sue An's just like, I don't know what I'm doing. There wasn't a lot of competition there. But we did have a three-way competition. Alicia, Kalina, and Sue An. Alicia tries to vindicate her send home dish with the scallop vessel. She wants to do an agua chile again, but they don't have scallops. This is not Top Chef scallop. This is not Top Scallop. This is Top Scallop vessel, apparently. And she does the seafood dish, the shrimp dish, and tries to redeem herself. Kalina does a trio, as Alicia says, a very ballsy decision to go with the right trio, because it is a axiom on Top Chef. This is not top duo. This is not top trio. Just do a top dish, right?
Margin for error. You get three chances to screw up. I was very worried for her when she chose that trio dish.
Me too. And maybe this is why I want to do a beef, you know, lifetime membership to the Beef Club, because I thought her dishes were awesome. I really thought that she executed really well. They looked so delicious. And Tom was in love with the tartare cut. It just looked awesome. So Kalina, you've redeemed yourself. I've been really high on you. I picked you up very high in the draft order, and really strong participation here. Sue on, the conspiracy theory is gaining steam, Kevin. The dots are connecting. There's another allusion to the wedding, the lovely wedding with he and his wife. And he says, you know, I better win this thing because, you know, I'm 100% confident that if I do well in this competition, she will love me and she'll say, it's fine. Don't worry about leaving me while I'm at a honeymoon by myself here, Sue. So Sue does the surprise in a box, which kind of felt like Justin Timberlake, Dick in a Box from SNL. It was a little odd, but he said, my surprise in a box, lamb carpaccio with the halibut, the surf and turf. Tom liked it. I thought there was a little bit of a, wait a minute, are we doing a duo here with the surf and turf? I thought maybe he would be sent home because duos don't really work on Top Chef, but Tom really liked it, Kevin.
Do we just think like Mrs. Sue Ahn is like sitting in a Ritz-Carlton in Jamaica, like alone right now? I mean, this is, I don't know that I even want to know the truth. I think speculating on the possibility of the truth is far more interesting than actually knowing at this point. But like, yeah, he just like, he got up, he left his honeymoon, really pissed off his new spouse and just decided, yeah, because I'm going to pack my red pants and I'm going to go to Last Chance Kitchen. I love it.
Okay. Now, I will ask you, Kevin, in the back of your mind as you're watching Last Chance Kitchen, it does kind of feel like Sue Ahn has to come back, doesn't he? Every time it's just like, you're bringing this guy back into the competition, right? You got. I mean, it's just odd. So it's a weird feeling because it's not like he's not earned it. He's absolutely earned his spot here. Like, it's not like he should have been sent home.
He's got some serious game.
Yeah.
I'm going to not only say that. If he gets back into the competition, Tom.
Ooh.
I think he's immediately a co-favorite. I've seen enough. I have seen enough in the Last Chance Kitchen to determine that if he gets in that main competition. And again, we talked about it. And I'm not trying to denigrate the field. But this ain't World All-Stars here.
Yeah.
This ain't World All-Stars here. This is sort of like one of those ATP tennis events where, you know, of the top 10 seeds, five are at the tournament. One of those like 500 level ATP. Like I'm telling you right now, if this guy gets into the competition, he has a very good chance to get on a plane for the Final Four. I've seen enough. There is some serious game. If you have not checked out Last Chance Kitchen, I'm telling you, he's kind of a mad scientist, too. He is an any pitch, any count kind of guy. Tom, he is doing some crazy stuff. He is not playing it safe in that Last Chance Kitchen.
Yeah.
This guy has serious game. Watch out. If you have an auxiliary draft right now, negotiate with your fantasy league. You want this guy on your team. I'm telling you, it's for real.
Think about that. Where right now would you put Sue Ahn, who's in Last Chance Kitchen? He's not even in the real bracket. Do you burn a first overall pick on a contestant in Last Chance Kitchen? I don't think you do. I think I go Danny. I go Danny number one. If there's a redraft right now, I go Danny number one. I go Michelle number two. Maybe Rossica at number two. Sue Ahn's close. He's close in there.
Yeah, I'd say if he gets back in.
Okay.
And I think they've got a couple more. They got a couple more to do. I think Charlie's got a face off against Clint and Sue Ahn to be continued. I think that's a two-parter, usually to whittle it down. But if he gets back in, I'm telling you, this guy's got some serious game. And it's not just that he's winning. He's doing crazy stuff. It is the kind of improvisational risk management that you like to see in a Top Chef contestant.
Yeah, I'm rooting for him because he's really talented. And I'll say for... If you haven't watched, because we everyone knows who listens to Pack Your Knives, that we love Last Chance Kitchen. It's a great show. They've hit it out of the park again with Dish with Kish. And Kevin and I are going to do a review on Dish with Kish. I watched the one with Buddha. It's an outstanding show. I thought it was some of the best Top Chef programming we've seen. It's new. It shows Kristen's personality in ways that we just don't have enough time to get on the real mega show. And I just thought, I think it's a really good product. So if you haven't done that yet, go catch The Dish with Kish. It will be well worth your time. I think it's a really good addition to Kevin. Like, how many, You know, people are always wondering how deep the NBA is. How many teams could you have in the NBA and still have like a really good product? Like how many spinoff Top Chef shows could you have without diluting the product? Because each one that they've done, Last Chance Kitchen and with Dish with Kish, they're top shelf products.
Yeah. And you don't even need the format of the main show, right? I mean, what's great about Dish with Kish is it's a lot of different things. Well, one is, as you say, it's completely unvarnished. The way you put it, I think in our first conversation about it was, hey, they take out the fourth wall.
Yeah.
So it's really kind of just, it's natural. Like you get, it's almost like you're hanging out with them. It's intimate. They're totally themselves. They seem like real people. If you're a home cook, you're going to pick up a couple of fun things. Just little hacks. So it has the benefit of a cooking show where if you watch like I do to say, hey, I'm just looking for some tricks and some shortcuts. So it has it all. And you get to just visit with people you like. I mean, one of the nice things is if you know, hey, Buddha's been with us for a couple of seasons now. Like you want to spend more time with Buddha more than just the occasional once a season judges table, right? Stephanie Seymour, et cetera, et cetera. Amar makes an appearance. I haven't watched that one yet and I'm really looking forward to it. I have it bookmarked. So yeah. Dish with Kish. We're going to do some Dish with Kish stuff here. We got to figure out our strategy, incorporate it into Pack Your Knives. But you and I are both emerging as big fans of that show.
Yeah. I hope we weren't too curmudgeon-y about this episode. I just think the team challenge, we did a double elimination last week where it was kind of team challenge-y. And then we did another team challenge. And then we're going to get Restaurant Wars here in a few episodes. I think it could have been executed a little bit differently. And that doesn't mean that someone got sent home that didn't deserve to get sent home. It's not like we had a Nina Compton situation or something where it felt like the winner didn't get an opportunity to win because of a technicality or whatnot. But it does seem like I'll put it this way. I'm good on team challenges for a while.
I'm with you. I think they have to just be selective. Like Restaurant Wars is the perfect team challenge because it is truly a team challenge, right? You like a double elimination team challenge, but not if one person has to pay for the sins of the others. And it just seems like team challenges introduce a level of unfairness. And also, I actually want to get back to watching. There's some really interesting chefs. And at the end of the day, and maybe it's just my temperament, I kind of just want to see I want Danny to be able to do his thing. I want to watch what this guy has. I want to see, go back to Michelle, getting to be Michelle, not taking the sloppy second. So I'll do dessert with like 1 ounce of pineapple for 50 people. Like I want to see Michelle do Michelle. I want to see Danny do Danny, you know? And I think that's where I'm looking forward to a little more individually oriented stuff. I'm with you there. I like a team challenge, but I'm good for a while. I'm good until Restaurant Wars. How about that?
I am too. And I think we're going to get a good episode next week. It's not a bad, I'm really enjoying the heck out of this season. So it's not that.
Oh yeah, totally.
Yeah. That's my final thought here. And by the way, just shout out to Stephanie Seymour, who has a little cameo on the Buddha episode with Dish with Kish. Would really, if you're listening to this, would really love to have you on Pack Your Knives. So we're going to get an invite out to you. Cause you're the culinary director of Top Chef, which is so cool.
What a cool job that is.
Yeah.
What a cool job.
I don't even know what the entire job entitles, but I think Leanne Wong did that at some point for Top Chef. So it does feel like a emeritus role. Like once you've been on Top Chef, you kind of know the game and be the culinary director. But she's, like you said, she's awesome. And she was awesome on Pack Your Knives. And I can't wait to... If she will allow us, I would love to have her unpack your knives to understand not just being a culinary director for Top Chef, but she's on set with the Dish with Kish and all that. I want to hear what it's all about.
Tom, looking forward to that interview. We're going to get it set up. Stephanie, please come on. Any other closing thoughts or we have set our piece here?
I think we've set our piece and I still feel I'm team beef even after the beef bros blew it.
And I'm still team pescatarian curious. For Tom Haberstroh, for producer Anthony Mays, this is Kevin Arnovitz, and this is Pack Your Knives.